keep it live, cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here, holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this, cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling. When you feeling them flares, they can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch the scenario, my stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, know through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, know through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah. Just nod your head with it, so explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it, no scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool, hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so, no overdose cause it's dope. Yo man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursuing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again, with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. Thank you all for tuning in. Make sure you also catch us on the antimedia.org/radio. We just edited the radio page because apparently our editor caught some typos in it. Sorry about that, but you know, typos aside, you know, our intentions are good. I know the path to hell is paved in good intentions, but I assure you, we seriously do have good intentions. Anyway, oh man, really happy to be back with you. So many things going on that we're going to talk about tonight. First, we're going to go into what's going on in North Dakota, and we're going to briefly go over that. Anybody out there listening tonight is actually there in North Dakota at the pipeline standoff. I encourage you to call in. We're going to be taking a couple calls tonight from our listeners. The call-in number is 718-717-8296. Please just, if you do get on the line, mute your microphone. Make sure the radio is not playing. Otherwise, we're going to get some like feedback. It's going to mess up our audio. But if you do get on, especially if you're in North Dakota, just give us some time and we'll get to you based on your area code. Because we want to talk about what's going on up there, because this is turning into a big event. And, you know, we're going to have to see how it plays out there. It's turning into a big standoff between the government, big oil, and Native Americans. And other activists are showing up. We've got a couple people in our team that are heading there right now. I don't think they're there yet. We're trying to get word back from them. It's kind of tough getting communications right now because I'm also hearing that they're trying to shut down some cell phone connections out there and stuff like that. We don't know what exactly is happening, but we're going to get updates as soon as we can. But either way, we're going to talk about what is going on over there, what we do know. The first thing that we do know is that the mainstream media is like not talking about this, and I just that really blows my mind. Our longtime co-host DB Schwartz is a little bit closer to the area, and he's joining us on the line tonight. DB, what's going on, man? What do you know about what's going on up there in North Dakota?
Yeah, basically they're like an 8-hour drive from here, and I know essentially most of the Plain tribes have come together. They've cut off their water supply, and now they're using jamming, like you've said. But it's super important because the river that they're talking about essentially crossing that could potentially burst and poison that river, it's essentially an artery into a huge aquifer. And that aquifer runs underneath Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, part of it, and then Illinois and stuff. Basically, what it does is it feeds the breadbasket of our country with an underground ocean, essentially, of fresh water. So you can imagine what would happen if we had a problem there where now our food production's cut in half. Does anyone see that as potentially dubious? I mean,
Yeah, that does seem like a not a good idea. DB, I don't know if your mic got cut there or not, but I wanted to ask you about our introduction meme tonight, kind of shed some light on the hypocrisy going on with the media coverage. I mean, just recently in Oregon, there was this standoff with the feds between this white militia up there that, you know, they were occupying some federal building, which was like, you know, some museum or nature center or something like that. And it was like a media frenzy. It's like, everybody, let's talk about these white guys that are, you know, holding up this building and not letting people go see the birds and stuff. But then when we come to this issue here where these Native Americans are like fighting for a legitimate issue here, like you just mentioned, the implications here are huge. The water supply right there, the water table, it's massive over there, and it supplies a lot of the crops, the wheat, you know, the bread for the
entire it's half the food, Nick. Imagine if tomorrow just imagine if tomorrow all the crops in California died. It's essentially the same thing. And even more. So, I mean, you cannot compare it to the Bundy Ranch scenario, which were a bunch of basically rich dudes that were basically trying to fight the Fed to get some of their land that they said was appropriated from them, eminent domain. But those are the games and the rules you play underneath when you live in the corporate United States. If we want to take the country back, it's not going to be with a handful of cowboys at a nature preserve. It would be what's going on right now if other people would get over there.
Yeah, so, you know, why do you think what is with this media coverage, man? Because this is just ridiculous. We have a story up about it on the anti-media. Native Americans successfully block oil construction pipeline. Media silent. This went out late last week, but it got a huge amount of people reading it and a lot of shares and went pretty viral. But people are kind of catching on to this media bias, and I have my own theory, but I wanted to see what you think about this.
Well, I mean, what affects real change? I mean, actually blocking that pipeline would really do something major, and it would set a precedent. The other thing was just like a circus. It was honestly had so many psyop connotations to it, trying to get people riled up, trying to get people to form militias that were armed and go against a government which has obviously drones they can call in and did for surveillance and probably could have fired on the Bundy situation any time, dude. It's one's a circus and one's the reality of what we could do to affect change. We could physically get in the way. They're using horses. These cops can't do anything. If the cops do anything, it becomes a whole scenario there. So they're doing what's perfect. Block them, block commerce. That's the only way you can affect change. If we block DC, we would do something. But getting violent with them is what they want, and petitioning and voting and all that other stuff is so passive that they'll just find a way to cook the books for the results.
Oh, man. Yeah, great point. Let me bring in a couple of our like I said, we're going to be trying to solicit some calls here from anybody that's listening out in North Dakota. Hopefully you can still get your phone to connect. If you're listening on your computer, keep in mind you can listen to the show on your smartphone. We're trying to figure out a way to get it to people's dumb phones too, but smartphones, you can go on theantimedia.org/radio. You can listen to us on the go. And also, if you missed the show, you can catch us on YouTube, UCY TV on YouTube. Look up the channel and subscribe to it and get all the anti-media radio shows. SM Gibson, who does the show on Tuesday and Thursday with his co-host, they've been getting a lot of viewers, and they did a great show on what's going on down in Louisiana. Another thing that has been downplayed by the media, you know, it's kind of surprising because the media normally loves to latch on to natural disasters and stuff like that. But the huge floods down in Louisiana have gone relatively underreported. And so there was a huge show that SM Gibson did, had some people call in from Louisiana. That got a bunch of people listening and donating, and we've mobilized people to go down there and actually help. So that's like really good news. So if you want to call in from North Dakota, please do 718-717-8296. But now we're going to go to our special co-host, Jake Anderson. What's up, Jake? How you doing tonight? Jake, are you muted? Can't hear you. Jake's been having connectivity issues over there.
I think he's aligning his chakras.
Hey, I'm here. I'll talk to you in a minute. Yeah. What was the question? I'm sorry.
Nothing, man. We're just kind of introducing you. DB said that you were busy aligning your chakras, and that's why you probably weren't answering.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was doing.
There you go. Enjoying some pasta, maybe?
No. Some. Apparently the walls in our apartment are paper thin. So for a show like this, you notice I'm lowering my voice. I guess all of my neighbors can hear me loudly pontificating crazy political theories. So I'm going to have to get some soundproof insulation. But no, I'm really interested in the Native American protest thing. I'm woefully uneducated about that, so I'm going to read the article right now.
Cool, man. So, you know, the first theme I want to talk about, because we've got our promotional meme for the show, is talking just simple abstract theories about why is the media really, the mainstream media, not talking about this standoff in North Dakota, yet at the same time they were like in a media frenzy about these guys that recently, this militia that recently in Oregon was taking over that building. Jake, I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, what do you think is like causing this?
Well, there's clearly, an incentive for the government to kind of utilize the vitriol of right-wing militias to, you know, clamp down on a number of civil liberties. For one, it stigmatizes the idea of us organizing in the first place for protest. Because they're using a particularly, you know, cantankerous bunch that most Americans don't agree with to do it. You know, they're also able to clamp down, of course, on Second Amendment issues. And just in general, it makes the idea of organizing look bad, and it makes the government look good, because look at the people who are anti-government. On the other hand, the Native Americans in this, you know, protest are speaking of a systemic issue that goes across the board, which is how the U.S. is stripping indigenous cultures of environmental rights and private, and which are then privatized. So there's clearly an incentive for them to use the media to glorify one, while not using the media at all to silence the other.
Great point, man, and that's kind of what I was thinking too. The thing that went on in Oregon, and you know, I think one of the guys from Bundy Ranch wound up going up there, and then he got arrested, and then the Lavoie Finicum guy ended up getting killed by the FBI, and all that stuff was on video too. Really sad what happened to that man. But you're right. I think the government, and of course the media, which is, you know, the mainstream media in the United States, has become an extension of kind of U.S. government propaganda. We hasn't got to the point where we can call it state-run media yet. There are several outlets like Voice of America that actually literally are U.S. state-run media. But, you know, New York Times, mainstream media, it is kind of an extension of U.S. propaganda. And by publicizing what was going on at that ranch, or, you know, up at that place in Oregon with this white militia, it was really advantageous because they could demonize gun rights. They could, you know, say, hey, look at these crazy right wingers and look at these, you know, look what they're doing. It had the leftists, and I remember so many of my so-called progressive friends on Facebook were like calling these guys in Oregon, they were calling them terrorists. They were saying, why haven't these guys been killed yet? The government needs to just storm the place and shoot anybody that doesn't surrender. I mean, I was like horrified by the comments I was seeing on my newsfeed. And then at the same time, looking at how polarized the country is, and this is kind of the theme I'm heading into here, you've got other people that I also see on my newsfeed that are like right-wingers or alt-right-wingers and things like that, that are like talking shit about the Ferguson protesters, the Black Lives Matter movement, and saying, why don't we just run these people over when they block freeways and block streets? It kind of just goes to show how damn polarized and manufactured this sentiment is, because in reality, if you look at what the protesters were talking about in Oregon with this right-wing militia, and you look at what the Black Lives Matter movement stands for, the movements aren't that far apart ideologically. They're actually both kind of fighting for like rights, and they're fighting for, you know, equality in some way or another. Yet the media has manufactured and, you know, pushed us into this direction of the entire country is so goddamn polarized that like people that are slightly too on the other side of the spectrum are like, why don't we just kill these right wingers? And people that are on the other side of the spectrum are like, well, why don't we just run over these left wingers? And that's why I think a lot of things get polarized and popularized by the media. Now, this thing that's going on in North Dakota, it's not so simple. You can't just say, oh, look at these bad Native Americans. They're standing up for their own land rights, and they're trying to protect their water supply. I can't believe how awful they are. We need to just go in and kill them. You can't exactly do that, because this isn't a group that you can just polarize and say, oh, left versus right, right versus left. Everybody, I think, is in agreement that the Native Americans have been so utterly screwed in this country that they deserve anything that they, you know, that they are standing up and fighting for. They deserve it because they've already been so screwed. So this to me is why the topic isn't being covered in the media, because it's not polarizing. It's as simple as that. It's not polarizing. We can't turn the left against the right, or the black people against the white people, or the brown people against the white people, or whatever it is that the media narratives try to hijack nowadays. It's not possible in North Dakota, because these people are standing up not only for their own ancestral rights and their own land, but they're standing up for the well-being of the water system for the Midwest, which DB mentioned at the beginning of the show. They're standing up for the entire farming and food supply of the United States.
Nick, it's really simple. If something were to happen that would get into that aquifer and poison it, you know, some oil leak or something like that, that's the end of half of all food production in the U.S. If you think food prices are high now, you're going to get starved out if there's an oil leak on that pipeline.
So, you know, you'd think there'd be a little bit more media coverage on this, and unfortunately there hasn't been. We've covered it here and there. Our sister site, Underground Reporter, has been covering it. We've got some people on the way to North Dakota, and hopefully they'll be getting there soon. Let me check my phone and see if we have any. All right. Derek Bros is actually there, so I'm going to try to get him to call in from North Dakota. He just texted me back, so we're going to see if he can call in and give us an update about what's going on the ground. This thing is big. I mean, they're trying to move like tar sands oil through this pipeline, which that in itself is a problem. Jake, are you familiar with the tar sands situation? All right, Jake's aligning his chakras again. So tar sands is like a really, really dirty, dirty crude oil, and it's very resource intensive as far as bringing it to market and getting it cleaned up. And it's basically what's going on in the tar sands in Canada, where it's basically destroying the environment up there. I mean, the place looks like a wasteland. That in itself is controversial, and this is the same reason why people have been kind of critical of the Keystone Pipeline, which is more or less kind of not happening at the moment. But people are already kind of like up in arms just about the oil itself. It's really bad, nasty oil. It's really bad on the environment. Takes a lot of resources to clean up. This isn't the kind of sweet crude that comes from Saudi Arabia. This is really nasty stuff, and it's like when they mine it, it's in like solid form. It's almost like charcoal, and then they have to like refine it down to liquid and clean it up, and it just really destroys the environment, lets a lot of pollutants out. it's just not a good situation. But the good news is that these tribes, first it started with, you know, the people in the local area in North Dakota, the Lakota peoples, and several other tribes up there. Now there's tribes from all over the country really joining in, and this is quickly becoming probably one of the biggest meetings of tribes in a really long time. So luckily, this bad scenario is bringing a bunch of people together, and like I mentioned, there's not really any opposition other than the pipeline and the government goons that are being sent in to try to get these people out of the way. And now they've resorted to some pretty bad, nasty tactics. And I'm pulling from an article here, originally posted on commondreams.org. We published it on the anti-media. Government pulls water supply from Dakota protesters despite sweltering heat. let's see what we have here. People are getting overheated now already, said John Lingling, the tribe's emergency response coordinator, as temperatures hovered around 90 degrees on Monday. It's very hurtful. He's talking about how the government decided to cut water off to the protesters as a form of trying to get them out of the way. And it kind of just goes to show how dirty the tactics are that they're willing to stoop to. I mean, this is crazy. Just to build a pipeline for these huge oil companies, they're willing to cut water off to people. I mean, this is weaponizing of water, something that we're pretty familiar with. It's being used, you know.
It's all you got to know is 100% of that oil is going to China. That's all you have to know. They're going to put our food supply at risk to pay back China's debt with this raw, disgusting, freaking, like, clay-like crude that, honestly, we're going to double-charge China is what we're going to do. We're going to pipeline it to our refineries because they can't handle it, and then we're going to ship them the refined stuff. So we're going to charge them for the oil, for the refining. I mean, it's just like what we do with coal, Nick. I don't know if you know this, but China, the south of it is, there's the mountain range that separates north and south enough to where we ship them coal. It's cheaper than them actually getting it over there by rail. So it's all geopolitics, and it's at the expense of the people. I mean, if there's an oil leak and half the food supply in the U.S. stops being grown for a year or two while they clean it up, it's not going to affect the people that put the pipeline up. They'll just buy more expensive food. They don't care. It'll affect me and you. I mean, already, what do you pay a month in food? Imagine it going up twice, three times, whatever.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's not a good scenario when it comes to, like, the overall prospects here. I mean, food's already bad enough. I mean, it's already expensive. We're already dealing with out-of-control inflation and, you know, just rocketing food prices and stuff. And, you know, the thing that's ironic here is that these guys are out there protesting to protect the water supply for themselves and for everyone else around. And then the government decides to take away all the water tanks and all the water supply they have around there. I mean, it's just a huge, huge slap in the face. And the other thing here that really sucks is you know, the Native Americans in the United States have already been robbed of their lands. Like, the entire country used to be theirs, and they were pushed off and, you know, forced into these reservations, and these, you know, the amount of land that they had has been, you know, steadily declining since the days that the Europeans originally arrived here in the United States. And, you know, this isn't North Dakota. This is not by far the only instance of where, you know, Native Americans, even though the tiny bit of land they have left is being robbed or polluted. I mean, there's so many instances where the reservations where Native Americans have been kind of pushed, you know, forced to kind of resign to, have been destroyed environmentally by the energy industry. I mean, looking at here in the Southwest, I mean, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, other places where they were mining uranium on these Native American reservations, and then the government never bothered cleaning it up. I mean, people are still being poisoned by this stuff, and there's been several cases recently with John McCain and how he sold the rights to some land that was considered, it wasn't part of an Indian reservation, but it was considered part of their kind of holy land. He sold the rights to a multinational mining company so they can go in and mine it for copper and other, you know, other precious metals and things like that. So it's the screwing over of Native Americans has been, you know, centuries in the making, but it's not going to stop. It's not stopping, and it's just continuing to be, you know, worse and worse. Even the little bit of land they have left, it's like, anytime they want, the government comes in. It's like, oh, eminent domain. We're taking your land. We're going to build a pipeline through it, or we're going to go mine the shit out of it, or we're going to, you know, let this uranium mine just pollute your area the whole time and not clean it up. I mean, how many places, how many different sites does there have to be in the United States where Native Americans are getting the short end of the stick, their places are getting polluted, before people start saying, you know what, enough is enough. Like, we need to stop letting this happen. I mean, what's it going to take? It's just ridiculous.
Environmental justice in general, I think, it's kind of incredible how long it's taking for it to be at a breaking point where people just aren't going to take it anymore. I guess it's going to be the point where their houses are flooding, and I guess people truly don't care unless it's literally killing them.
And even that, I mean, the thing going on down in Louisiana, it's like, Does anybody even give a shit about the people in Louisiana and what they're going through right now? Doesn't seem like it, really.
They use, you know, propaganda to say that it wasn't, that it's not climate change, you know, even though every single scientific model ever created shows that it's from carbon emissions. They still somehow, the alt-right movement, I loved your post about that earlier, by the way, you know, they spin that. But yeah, it's environmental justice is not going to be felt for a long time, unfortunately, in my opinion.
And what they're going to do is they're going to circumvent what would actually be a movement and do something like slap a carbon tax unilaterally on everything that burns carbon. And that's everything. And if you think people right now that are stuck in a shitty position with student debt and they don't make enough money to get by can go buy a Tesla, you're out of your mind. So overnight, you're going to see everybody get relegated to either scooters or the bus, and the rich are going to just go to Teslas.
And yeah, my opinion on a carbon tax has definitely shifted. As I see now what they're trying to do, but yeah, it's not a good situation.
Huge problems with the carbon tax. I mean, it's carbon tax is something that the biggest players can survive, and everyone else that's trying to compete and provide innovation in the industry they'll bite the dust.
Even the moderately wealthy will be totally fine, but anybody that's middle class or below, you're just going to get squeezed out by energy, food, and healthcare, and you're going to have a permanent poor class simply because of policy. If we had some things like Europe had, a social safety net, a lot more people would be doing a lot better off. But you're brainwashed into thinking the military deserves 57% of our GDP.
You know what? I was just reading an article by who's the guy that tweeted that he would write the defense of the drone strike that kills Assange? Grunwald. I was reading this article by Grunwald, and it's basically an impassioned defense of the Obama years, and he was, you know, making all these claims about the environment, you know, environmental progress that Obama has made. And I don't know, it feels like greenwashing to me. I don't think Obama has done as much as some people might like to think in terms of pushing environmental reforms, if that's how you want to go about it. You know?
I mean,
how much environmental damage do Hellfire missiles do?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing, dude, and that's where the hypocrisy really lies. And, you know, these governments can't sit here and you know, looking at the Rio Olympics, I mean, the opening ceremony from Brazil is like, oh, we need to do more about climate change, and we got to really, you know, clean up our act when it comes to the climate. Brazil is one of the worst violators of the climate. They're chopping down the rainforest. Like, they're almost, you know, they're going to chop down the whole rainforest if they continue the rate they're going.
How many millions of people flew in?
Exactly. And the water in Rio, did you guys see that picture? The guy that was he was riding a surfboard out there in Rio. I mean, there's like just ridiculous amount of trash out there. The place is completely screwed. I mean, environmentally, the Rio is done.
God, dude, we could go on for a whole show about Brazil. Why is it not as rich as us?
Yeah. Well, they're trying to get that way, but it's so corrupt down there. But back to Obama, man, this hypocrisy with Obama and, like, you know, pushing the climate agenda and stuff. I mean, cool and all, but actions speak a lot louder than words, dude. The Defense Department, the you know, the Department of Defense is the biggest single polluter on Earth. You know, we burn through more fossil fuels with the military than anybody else, any single other organization does, you know. And so unless we start, you know, addressing that and addressing the global empire that we're putting on, we can't really talk about climate change, because the United States is, along with China, are the two biggest contributors of it. You know, and so it's just more empty rhetoric and, you know, all that.
The one area that no one seems to be able to dare touch, like, not even minor reform seems to ever go on in the military, aside from, you know, gay rights and that's, you know, allowing them to serve, allowing women to serve. Of course, you could take the alternate approach and say you're allowing them to serve, you know, war crimes, but it you know, that's progress. But in terms of cutting military spending and diverting some of that into renewable energy projects, it's incredible to me how impossible that seems to be.
And they are doing it, but it's like, God, it's like turning the Titanic. You know, we're so addicted to oil. We're literally fighting other countries with the military so that we can have an oil base to keep fighting other countries for their oil. Like, and it'll just never end because we can't stop it. So,
we're going to try to get Derek to call in. I'm not sure if our phone lines are working tonight, unfortunately. I think they're forwarding the voicemail, but we're going to try to get Derek on. He said he was trying to call in, but I don't think it's working. So for now, I want to shift a little bit into what we were talking about Monday, because Monday we dedicated a lot of time to what's going on with like Turkey and stuff. And so today in the morning, we got some big news out of Turkey, and Turkey's invading Syria. You guys see that? Turkey is now invading Syria on the northern border, because, you know, Turkey borders Syria in the north. They sent their tanks in, and they're supposedly going after ISIS. We got a really interesting story on the anti-media regarding Erdogan and this recent terror attack that went on Sunday. On Sunday, there was a big attack at a wedding in Turkey. It was a Kurdish wedding. 54 people dead, supposedly done by a kid that was strapped up with bombs. Turkish President Erdogan immediately blamed ISIS for the attack, but the strange thing here is that ISIS didn't take responsibility for it. And now, as everyone knows, ISIS takes responsibility for almost every terrorist attack around the world. Even the Orlando attack, which was, you know, was clearly not ISIS. It was just some lunatic that supposedly called up and said that he was pledging allegiance to ISIS. ISIS took credit for that as well. So the fact that ISIS hasn't taken credit for this attack is very interesting here, even though Erdogan has immediately blamed them without even, you know, seemingly as if there was no investigation. It was just immediate, like, oh, it was ISIS. And he hasn't provided any evidence. In fact, there hasn't been any evidence to show that ISIS was responsible for it. However, that hasn't really stopped Turkey from invading Syria, and they said it's because of the terror attack. Now, kind of predictably, Turkey is going after Kurdish forces in, you know, the northern Syria areas, because Turkey is very worried that there's going to be some kind of breakaway Kurdish autonomy movement, which has been building and building for a long time. I mean, Kurdish are kind of like, in the Middle East, they've kind of been treated like Native Americans have been treated here in the United States. They've been screwed by like every country over there. I mean, Iran screws them, Syria screwed them, Turkey screwed them, Iraq screwed them constantly. I mean, Saddam Hussein launched chemical attacks on them with weapons that the U.S. was like providing him too. And at the time in the 80s, we turned the other way and didn't bother us a bit. That was back when he was our ally, you know, but the Kurds have been screwed for a long time, so it's not a big surprise that the Kurds are trying to move and, you know, kind of consolidate their movement into a autonomous country for themselves, where they're not ruled over by Iraq or Syria or Turkey or Iran. I mean, their territories, the Kurdish homeland, kind of is on the mountains that kind of straddles all of those different countries, so they're screwed by all of them. And so the Kurds, especially in Turkey, I mean, the Kurds make up, I think, about 20% of the Turkish population, and they've been a thorn in the side of Erdogan since he took office. In fact, I mean, the Kurdish party, political party, is the single greatest reason why Erdogan hasn't been able to turn that country into a dictatorship yet, because they maintain a strong political presence over there, and they're the only party preventing him from turning it into Saudi Arabia over there. So, you know, Erdogan blames this attack on ISIS. He starts bombing and invading Syria now, but instead of going after ISIS, he's going after the Kurds. I mean, DB, what do you make of this?
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. It reminds me kind of of the Vietnam War buildup, where the Viet Cong started going after the Hmong. I know you kind of know a little bit, and we've touched on them. They're a mountain tribe or a hill tribe in Vietnam that fought on our side, and they bore a lot of the brunt of the early and even the post-war casualties simply because they were already there. They were kind of like an insurgent force, and I just fear, you know, for the Kurdish people, essentially, will use them in that same puppet capacity, especially in these pre-war months, because they're not moving all this armory and setting everything up to do nothing. Something will happen. It may be short-lived. It may be a couple days. I mean, who knows how advanced the stuff is. We got moved around now, but they're going to pop it off, and they're going to use the Kurds, and I just feel for them, man. It sucks what position they're in right now.
It sucks, dude. They've been screwed for centuries. They've been being screwed over there. And as you mentioned, they are being used now as a proxy force for the United States. I mean, because they're actually fighting for their homeland, they're very effective. I mean, they're a legitimate organic counterbalance to ISIS and to every other government in the region, including the Syrian government, the Turkish government, the Iraqi and the Iranian government. I mean, the Kurds are a legitimate counterbalance to all of those because they have that organic, you know, incentive to fight for their own homeland, and that's why they're so effective. That's why they're kicking the shit out of ISIS. I mean,
somebody once said it's kind of a weird thing to compare them to Israel, because Israel was plopped down and just kind of created out of thin air. So it's always going to be fighting its neighbors, but essentially Kurdistan or what they want to create would be totally organic. Those people have been there for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, so they totally deserve a homeland. If we are waving that as a carrot in front of them, I don't know. That's what it seems like sometimes.
It definitely seems that way. And then, you know, it's also been very important in Iraq that they've been trying to keep the Kurds in the north of Iraq as part of, like, the, you know, Iraqi coalition government and stuff like that. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that the Kurds have been pretty much the most effective fighters against ISIS and against the Assad regime as well. But the issue here is that the Kurds aren't exactly trying to advance their positions and trying to conquer. They're not trying to conquer Syria. They're just trying to break away their homeland away from all these horrible governments. And so Turkey's kind of throwing their hat in this mess makes the whole situation even more convoluted than it already is. We talked about this Monday, very, very complex scenario going on in Syria. I mean, it's basically become World War III proxy war, basically. I mean, everybody has joined in, including China, obviously Russia, the United States, Saudi Arabia, all the big players are, you know, bombing in Syria against each other. And now with Turkey throwing its hat in there, it really even mucks the situation up even worse because, you know, we got to look at the recent news that has come out of Turkey. First of all, it was only a couple months ago or several months ago that Turkey shot down a Russian jet, right? And all of a sudden Russia was like, oh shit, you know, we're not going to let this happen. All of a sudden Russia released all of its intelligence showing that Turkey was either directly or indirectly financing ISIS, right, with the oil trade and with, you know, black markets, shipping fighters into Syria, shipping weapons into Syria. All that stuff came to light because Russia was like, okay, that's it. That's enough. We're going to expose what you guys are doing. And now recently with this coup attempt, many people have said that the coup was fabricated so that Erdogan could consolidate his power. Other people have said that the coup was foreign actors were trying to push this coup, including the United States. That was the accusation that came out of the Turkish government. After the coup, keep in mind, the people that the Turkish government has blamed for this coup, the leader of that movement is taking refuge in the United States. This guy lives in Pennsylvania. His name is Gulen, and he has a movement in throughout the Middle East, especially in Turkey. Ever since the coup, Erdogan has been cracking down on the Gulenites. Anybody that follows this guy, he's got a bunch of schools, he's got a bunch of businesses, he has a bunch of influence, whether it's in the military, in the government, very moderate kind of Islamic thinker, and Erdogan has basically declared war on everything that this guy's involved in, and that's why they've cracked down. And now, we just talked about on Monday, it was like 60,000. Now I'm seeing estimates of up to 100,000 people have been either fired or detained in Turkey in connection with the coup. Ever since the coup happened, though, this is the thing that's really interesting here, and this is the thing that I'm still not able to figure out, and I'm not sure if anybody is able to figure this out yet. Turkey has gotten a lot closer to Russia in the past few months. Ever since the coup, especially, Turkish-Russian ties have gotten a lot closer. And I don't know exactly what this is about. There's several angles here that we could look at. But, I mean, DB, what do you make of this?
Well, I think Russia provided Turkey some very, very solid evidence they were going to basically be offered up as a sacrifice in a land war with NATO. And they were going to become the essential chessboard because they're the land bridge. So why not? So I think when they realize that, maybe they really legitimately are going after ISIS now. And Erdogan just cemented power, and he's now a Putin.
You know, the Saudi Arabians can't just go in there and, you know, bomb the government and knock them out. The United States can't be open about their intentions in the region. I mean, if the United States was honest about it, they would just up and announce to the public, hey, look, guys, we're going to go bomb the Syrian government. We're going to knock them out. We're going to build a pipeline from Saudi Arabia into Europe. We're going to cut Russia out. We're going to make a bunch of money, and you guys are going to share in it. Like, if they were honest about it, maybe the United States public would be like, okay, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But instead, they're like, okay, we're going to fund the opposition. We're going to support democracy in Syria. We're going to, supply the rebels and fund the rebels and stuff. And we're not going to say exactly why. We're going to say that we're trying to fight ISIS, but we're not going to tell you our real intentions about toppling the Syrian government to build a big pipeline. But Russia, the reason their foreign policy, even though they have way less resources than we do, their military is much smaller. They're not as technically advanced. They don't have nearly the budget we have, but they're more effective. And the question is why? Well, it's because they're more honest about it. They're honestly saying, we're going to prop up the Syrian government because our economic interests tell us that we need to do that. And the United States is over here like, we're going to give democracy to Syria, so we got to underhandedly do this and do that, and we got to fight ISIS too. And so our foreign policy is ineffective because we're not honest about it. We're not putting the resources out there and legitimately using them to our objective, which is to build a big pipeline to make a bunch of money for Saudi Arabia. We're not being honest about that.
We're contractually obligated to never declare war again as of the results of our peace agreement with Japan after World War II. And a lot of people don't know that. So that was an agreement we made. They disarmed, and we said we would never declare war. And now, since we've kind of gone back on our word after 9/11, they've started to rearm. Has anyone noticed that?
That's another thing we talked about a little bit last show, and that is something that's very underreported. Japan is quickly turning itself back into a militarist state, and there's some very fascist leanings growing in Japan.
Wouldn't you, Nick? I mean, honestly, wouldn't you if you were Japanese leadership? You're like, whoa, the rule of law doesn't apply to the U.S. anymore after 9/11. Like, it's now a witch hunt worldwide for a global war on terror that has no borders, no boundaries, no actual enemies, just an ideology they want to crush. And that involves killing like half the world. So, yeah, let's rearm.
Seriously, right? It's like a free-for-all. I mean, we're not setting a good example here for the supposed free democratic world over here in the West. it's a troubling trend. We had a little data outage there for a second. Sorry if it went quiet. Anyway, we're back. But here's the thing that's scary. The entire world is trending in this direction of fascism. Even Japan. Japan has been considered the most passive nation since World War II. I mean, they were under obligation because of the U.S. sanctioned constitution they had. But that's all going out the window, man. It's already changed. The law already changed. There was actually a brutal... did you guys see that there was like a total slugfest in the Japanese parliament when they passed this new law saying that the Japanese could rearm and remilitarize. There was a slugfest in the parliament, dude. There was a bunch of politicians in there. Japan has traditionally been passive since World War II that were like, you know what, we're not going to stand for this. We don't want to see our country get demolished again in another huge war. We're going to stand up and fight for peace. And it turned into a slugfest, dude. People were throwing blows. This guy jumped up from a window sill and he threw an elbow from like, it was like professional wrestling stuff, dude. But it's in Japan, it's not gone quietly. I mean, there's been huge protests at military bases, American military bases. I mean, they're getting tired of the U.S. being over there. There's a nationalist tide rising in Japan and throughout the whole world. Fascism is coming back in a very strong way, be it in Europe, in France, the United Kingdom, Germany, Turkey, throughout the Middle East, Asia, the United States, all around the world, dude. This tide is rising. The stage is being set right now for some kind of stupid, huge global war. And right now, these guys are just positioning their chess pieces. And that's what's going on in Turkey.
It's an illusion war, Nick, because it's like the two proxies of the world are being used as puppets to fight it out by the actual two true masters of the world. And I'm This is like a theory I floated last episode and or last time we talked, and I still believe that as a result of what happened after World War II, that the U.S. is kind of controlled by Saudi Arabia and by Japan at the same time, and they're both kind of using us and leveraging us along with Israel to try to knock out Russia and then China, who are like the last two that are kind of standing in the way of like a global type of hegemony, if you can see that. But that's what it seems like, man, because we're so addicted to oil, we have to have Saudi Arabia. We're so addicted to high tech, we have to have Japan, because Japan makes all of our high tech, Japan and Taiwan and South Korea. So, of course, we have to protect all them. So we're totally beholden to like two invisible masters a lot of people don't see. A lot of people think the U.S. rules the world and we're like the global empire, but we couldn't be without Japan and without Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, someone's got to feed the beast, right? And that's what Japan and Saudi Arabia, you know, they function as the, you know, the producer. And we consume all that stuff, and we're the military arm of it. Many people would argue that England is the financial arm of the empire, too. It's not, you know, the battle, it's not just America standing on its own, and that's the issue here, too. We're looking like a lot of really troubling parts of history, at least looking back at like World War I, they're repeating themselves, man. I mean, look at these alliances, look at these really complex webs of treaties and defense agreements. You know, if one recent bit of news here that is real troubling is that the U.S. recently scrambled jets in Syria because the Syrian government flew their planes like too close to the U.S.-backed coalition or whatever. And this, the whole thing is just ridiculous, because it's like we're in Syria and their government, you know, the Syrian government flew its jets too close to our people. I mean, that to me is just like, oh shit, this is just ridiculous beyond anything I can believe.
Imagine when Hillary tries to enforce a no-fly zone. I mean, there's going to be dogfights all over the place.
I mean, think about this. It's like, who's the big boogeyman right now? All right, let's say Russia decided that its enemies, who are Russia's enemies? Let's say Russia was the main group fighting ISIS, right? And that Russia decided, you know what, ISIS is in the United States in Arizona, so we got to go over there, and we're not going to fight the U.S. government, but we're going to go in Arizona, and we're going to fight ISIS in Arizona. And if the U.S. government is flying its planes over top of our base, we're going to warn them, and that we might shoot them down if they violate our airspace. You know, this is like kind of what's going on over there in Syria right now. We're warning the Syrian government, hey guys, you guys are flying too close to our planes that are in your country. You know, and so that to me is just like, oh my God, like somebody slapped me. Is this reality? But, you know, we scrambled our jets.
I'd slap you if you were there, Nick.
What was that?
I said I'd slap you if I were there.
If you were here, you could slap me as many times as you want right now, because I can't believe this shit. But, you know, the U.S. scrambled its jets. It's warned the Syrian government that it'll shoot down. I saw a press conference today at the White House. A couple journalists asked the question, said, look, if the Syrians get too close and they seriously threaten U.S. assets in Syria, would you shoot down a Syrian plane? And the guy, I think it was a general or something, he said, yes, we'll defend coalition forces, blah, 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 blah. But see, this is getting dangerously close here to triggering a massive, massive conflict, because right now everyone, you know, everything's fine. Yeah, it sucks to be in Syria right now. But for everyone, you know, in Western Europe, in the United States, the people that live in Russia, you know, all the people that live in China, and, you know, everyone else that has nuts in the game right now, everything is kind of like, it's like the, what did they call it in World War II? The phony war. It's like the phony war. It's like, nah, it's all quiet on the Eastern Front. It's quiet on the Western Front. But, you know, in Syria, shit's going down right now. And the moment the U.S. shoots down a Syrian plane, all bets are off, dude. The Iranians have a defense agreement with Syria, meaning that if the United States shoots down a Syrian plane, that could trigger war with Iran. Everybody knows that Iran and Syria, very, very close allies to Russia. And Syria is a very, very close, and Iran, very, very close ally of China. So what we're looking at here, and this is why it gets me back to World War I, because World War I was supposedly triggered by just one guy getting assassinated in Serbia. All these alliances got triggered, and then all of a sudden you got, like, you know, dozens and dozens of countries that are saying, you know what, we're at war now because of one guy getting shot. Well, the same thing could happen here in Syria. We shoot down one plane, we shoot down the wrong plane. It could trigger the battle lines to be drawn, and it's, you know, Syria, Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, and several smaller, you know, minor countries. And it's NATO. It's the United States. It's Japan. It's Western Europe. It's Saudi Arabia and all of our other allies. You know, one wrong move, and then the lines are drawn, and then the battle is set. So all this positioning right now, yeah, it's a quiet war here in the United States. We don't have thousands of people dying over there. I mean, yeah, guys are still dying in Afghanistan here and there. More people are dying. More U.S. soldiers are dying from suicide right now than are dying in battle, which is a tragedy in itself. But, I mean, we're not having, like, massive casualties. Russia is not suffering massive casualties. I mean, they had, like, one helicopter get shot down. You know, maybe a dozen people have died in Russia's military so far in Syria. China hasn't had anybody die in a military battle in a long time. It's all quiet on the fronts. But, you know, the stage is being set right now in the Middle East, dude. And this is something, especially with if Clinton gets into office, I mean, it's almost a surefire bet that something much bigger is going to be triggered, because she's already pretty much telegraphed her intention to put a no-fly zone in Syria. And that is going to instantly trigger major conflict with Iran and therefore Russia and China. So, you know, what we're dealing with right now, and we're overdue. Look back at World War One. I mean, that was what, 1917 it started? World War Two, late 1930s, early 1940s. We're overdue for a major, major war. And not that I'm saying I hope it happens or that I'm expecting it, but just looking at the trends, looking at, like, history repeating itself, because it always does, I mean, something big is going to happen really, really soon. It's already past due.
And the bankers are going to make it happen, or we're going to have to take them out, Nick. Either we have a global Iceland, or we'll have a World War III, because they'll make it so that nations fight each other in desperation, just like they did in World War I and II, and make it about a scarcity, a false scarcity again. They'll just, you know, all we have to do is just start something with Iran, have them cut the strait, then oil skyrockets, then everything associated with the economy skyrockets, and people start getting desperate, man. And it's the same thing that happened in World War One and then World War Two. I mean, that's how we got out of the Depression, was the World War Two. So we're going to get out of the Great Recession with World War Three. The problem is that they think they're going to limit it in scope to some kind of proxy conventional conflict, but all it's going to take is an overwhelming loss on the side of Russia during one of those, where they retaliate with nukes. And then we have to do the same. So it's easy to see where the buildup will come.
Exactly, dude. And so this is something that we need to take really seriously. And as Jake mentioned, I mean, we've got equality now in drafting women into the armed forces, and gay people can serve as well. This is something that, and, you know, let's face it, the United States is still the single biggest economy and the biggest military power. And I've actually heard an Afghani activist talk about how the U.S. public is the most powerful entity. And it's true.
Yo, here we go through the stereo.